Looking sharp.
Okay, we'll go ahead and welcome to your capital. This is the House Committee on Consumer Government, General Government and Consumer Protection, Thursday, March the 3rd, 2011. I'll call the meeting to order. We'll also open a public hearing on House Bill 3241. Jan, if you'll give us the summary, and we'll ask Representative Sheehan and Widener and McClain if you want to join us up at the...
Chairs and committee members, House Bill 3241, it prohibits a person from picketing or engaging in disruptive activities at a service for a deceased person. It specifies that the picketing or disruptive activity must not occur within 300 feet of the property line. It provides that the prohibition applies to activities within 1 hour before until one hour after the service is held. Punishes with a maximum of 30 days imprisonment, $1,250 fine, or both.
Okay, and we do have a large public this morning, and we appreciate everyone being here to testify. We're going to try to have everyone that signed up testify. Hope you'll be concise in your comments, and the three legislators at the table this morning, welcome, and thank you for bringing this bill to us, and please remember to identify yourself first and give us your testimony. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Jim Widener from House District 24, which is most of Yamhill County, some of Polk County, and I might have a few acres in Washington County, possibly. So, I'm proud to be here before you this morning on House Bill 3241, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 3241 came to my attention when Arizona recently passed a similar bill, SB 1101, in response to those threatening to demonstrate and disturb the memorial service for victims of a shooting at a Congress on Your Corner event earlier this year in Tucson. I realize that Oregon is vulnerable to this sort of disturbing demonstration at funerals and memorial services, and I thought that we should draft some common sense bipartisan solution to protect both the freedom of speech and those who are mourning. My intent in this bill is to establish a buffer zone in which disturbing demonstrations, such as picketing, which disrupts a funeral or memorial service, would be located at a safe distance away from those facilitating and attending the funeral memorial service. I think that disrupting the service would include all actions that hinder or inhibit the anticipated and scheduled process of a burial service, memorial service, or other like service. I feel that this bill would not only protect freedom of speech and assembly by setting standards to their assembly, which would grant them their freedom, while offering the privacy to those to perform their funeral or memorial service for their loved one. I think that this bill would protect and acknowledge the solemn rights of family and friends to hold service for their loved ones without hindrance from outside agitators. With the passage of this bill, Oregonians who are grieving can know that they are protected during their time of mourning and vulnerability. This bill was drafted to reclaim acceptable acts of expression within a modicum of social activity and civility and respect for those who are being memorialized. With 38 co-sponsors, I'm excited to continue to gain momentum and support with this bill and move forward, and I thank you for your time and consideration of House Bill 3241.
Thank you very much. Representative Sheehan, would you give us your testimony?
Thank you, Chair Wisnett and Chair Holvey. My name is Patrick Sheehan. I represent House District 51, and I'd like to begin with a quote. The proper response to hurtful protests are general laws creating buffer zones around funerals and the like, rather than empowering of juries to punish unpopular speech. This was said by the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court yesterday. On appeal was a civil action where the father of a fallen Marine was awarded millions of dollars in damages against the Westboro Baptist Church. Members of the church protested his son's funeral in 2006. The headlines read, U.S. Supreme Court rules in favor of the Westboro Baptist Church. But make no mistake, the ruling had nothing to do with a right to assemble. It was about whether or not the courts could award damages for emotional distress. Our bill seeks to mitigate the emotional distress that a grieving family feels when their son or daughter's funeral is turned into a circus. Anti-gay, anti-Catholic, anti-Semitic, and anti-American messages are conveyed on colorful signs and designed to get media attention, which the church uses to communicate their constitutionally protected free speech. The bill does not silence them. It doesn't censor them. It doesn't deny them the right to assemble. It defines a buffer zone of 300 feet from the cemetery, church, or memorial site. Protesters and counter-protesters are treated equally in having to comply. The idea is not unique. In fact, 44 states already have a similar law pertaining to funeral protests. The idea of buffer zones is also nothing new. In the case of Madison versus Women's Health Center, the Supreme Court approved an injunction requiring a buffer zone between protesters and an abortion clinic entrance. The bill was modeled after successful legislation in other states. In fact, in the Supreme Court ruling yesterday, dealt with a funeral which had a 1,000-foot buffer zone, more than three times as long as our proposal. And it worked. The father who filed the suit didn't see the signs used to picket his son's funeral at the funeral. He saw them later on television. Buffer zones work. Buffer zones work. They are constitutional. They are well established in other states, and they're rarely needed. I join most Oregonians in being especially sensitive to my First Amendment rights, and this bill does nothing to erode them. I want to thank Becky Ginsback of Estacada for asking me to address this problem, and remind you that no one is given more to protect our Constitution and laws than the families of fallen soldiers. It's time for that rule of law to protect them in return. I urge your unanimous support of this House bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative McQueen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike McLean. I represent House District 55. I am currently not a co-sponsor of the bill, but I am a supporter of the bill. And the reason why I hesitated is, as a member of the Oregon Air National Guard and a strong supporter of free speech, I was concerned that the restrictions that were placed on speech in the name of honoring the military would be burdensome restriction. But I do believe, after having reviewed it and discussing with the sponsors and several concerned, that this is a proper time, place, and manner restriction that will honor free speech and for the very rights that our soldiers, airmen, Marines, seamen have fought for. And so I stand today and compliment the co-sponsors and give my full support of the bill and ask that the committee would do so as well.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Committee members, do you have questions? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm signed on the bill, very supportive of Veteran 2, and I really appreciate you bringing this forward. Thank you. My question is, Representative Sheehan, in your testimony, and maybe I misheard, but you were saying that it would treat them equally, protesters and supporters, but this bill is only against the supporters. Against the protesters. The reason I ask is, I take Patriot Guard riders for an example. Several friends of mine are participating in that. They're still allowed to come right up to the service and pay their respects and protect the family in this bill, correct?
Chair Wisnett, Chair Holvey, I believe so. I was referring to the counter-protesters that usually appear at these events to protest the Westboro Baptist Church. So it refers to picketers, so people holding signs.
Okay, I understand. Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions, committee members?
Yeah, I got a question.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is this actually gets to my couple of questions. I have no love for, and couldn't. It's hard for me to imagine participating in a funeral based protest. Right? I mean, I've had to go through family funerals, as probably everybody in the room has, and the idea that I think it's fair to use the word sanctity of that would be disrupted by a very non-family event is a bummer. I do have a couple of questions. The one brought on by Representative Matthews' question, which is, if we allow for protesting, if we allow for supportive conduct, but prohibit opposed conduct, okay, so if you're rooting for whatever happened, then it's okay, you can get as close as you want, but if you're opposed to it, you got to stay away. What is the confidence we have that that's not content-based discrimination under the First Amendment, and that in fact is constitutional? That differentiation seems to be about as content-based as I can think, and I'm wanting some confidence in that.
Representative Smith, I knew with you and Representative Conger up there with the great brain power of attorneys that we would need help, and that's why I asked our attorney to join us today, Mr. McLean.
But lawyer up.
We had to lawyer up, and it takes one to equal you two, but out of respect, that question went through my mind as well. And one of the things that I thought about on that, because I'm a strong supporter of free speech, but the thing that we run into is a safety issue. When you get the agitators that are coming up and you're trying to memorialize, with me having a son who's in the service and just getting ready to come back right now, and he's coming back alive and healthy, but if something were to happen to him and the protesters showed up, I don't know if I could control myself if they were interfering in my son's funeral. And to me, that's my right to be able to mourn the loss of my son in privacy. That's why we're trying to create a buffer zone to protect the agitators or protesters as well. The people that are there in support, they're not there to cause damage. They're there out of respect for that. When the Patriot Guard shows up, they're coming to honor that person for the loss of their life, for the service to their country. They're not coming to basically agitate and humiliate everybody that's there. We're going to allow them to continue to do that. We just want them to do it at a safe distance away to where it doesn't cause any other, basically incite violence. That's essentially what they can do when they get very close, is incite violence. It's something we don't allow. We wouldn't allow it at the state fair or any place else. They would be arrested for it, and they're almost borderline on that type of picketing that they do. And I'm going to turn it over to Representative McLean because he can give you more of a legal aspect of it.
Thank you. He's my friend and client. I'm just teasing. He's not my client. But I did have some reservations like you, Representative Smith, which is why I was slow to come to fully support this bill, because as a member of the military, as a member and an advocate for free speech and a member of the bar, I analyze this pretty closely, but I fully support it for this reason. The text of the bill does not target content. It targets disruption. And if you read in Section 1, it says a person may not picket, and then it goes on, it says, or engage in activities that are disruptive. We're not... the legislature is not being asked to target conduct. We don't know for what cause the person passed at a funeral, whether even indeed they are necessarily a member of the military, a firefighter, etc. The issue is the disruption, the picketing, the targeting of emotions for the purposes of causing distraught during this solemn occasion. And by placing a time, place, and manner restriction on the expression of that speech, it is a not only a constitutional permissible restriction, but it does create a harmony which will alleviate the tensions not only from the protesters, but as Representative Widener said, from those who mourn.
An idea, and I assume we might hear from the ACLU today. Representative Matthews and I were on the same side together on the opposite side of the ACLU yesterday. So I would imagine they might opine. Here is one thing we might offer to them, or one thing we might consider in the bill. We might say, maybe the disruptive thing does it, or we might say at the request of the host, right? You know, whoever's sort of in charge of the event. But imagine it's a parade. You got to have in the parade who you want in your parade. You get to have at your party who you want at your party. And you say at the request of the host, anybody the host wants can be somewhere else. That might be one thing. It might not matter. I want to think about this further and get a little advice personally and on the constitutional stuff. And my other question is on the distance, right? I don't know if there's any magic 300 feet. I don't know if there's any constitutional magic. I don't know if there's policy magic. So I sort of have a question about that. And I know it's like 10 feet's too short and 3 miles is too far. But, you know, wondering between 50 feet and 500 feet, what's the, you know, if there is rationale there that we should consider.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And let me apologize. Did you
want to respond? If they had a response, that'd be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I do think that is a legitimate question on whether 300 feet is a restriction that would inhibit the effect of the protest, which is ultimately not a speech issue. And why I am satisfied that 300 feet is constitutionally permissible as well as the right thing to do. I believe the co-sponsors and the chief sponsors and the supporters, when looking at that, took into consideration from the standpoint that the effect on the listeners, the effect on the mourners of the protest is not a speech element that has to be factored. They fully, where they are, 300 feet away, will be fully able to express their speech, and the buffer zone is reasonable in the light of where most funerals are located, and given the layout of cemeteries and the like homes and navigating the processionals. In the end, when you look at the content of the speech, there is no restriction in that regard.
Chair Wisnitz, Representative Smith, I just wanted to reiterate that this was based off a model of several other states that have done this, and they have varying distances. The one that was in the news yesterday was 1,000 feet. Legislative Council spent a lot of time trying to make sure that ours was liberal enough for Oregon to accept. And,
so we're 700 feet different than that state.
Right, we're 700 feet away.
They're between us and whoever that was.
So. Right. But yeah, I think it's based on a good model with proven methods, and I think it will survive.
Thanks.
Good comments. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, and right now we're, of course, talking about veterans, but this is a funeral service for any Oregonian, quite honestly. And it's easy to kind of take that into context and say, this is about our veterans, because unfortunately we're having veterans' funerals, and it's unfortunate that we do that. Oregon's getting pretty good at the mobilization ceremonies. It'd be nice to stop that. But having said that, when I look at a group like the Patriot Guard Riders, they specifically state on the website, they are acting as invited guests of the family. And there's a big difference there. And I appreciate your comments, Representative McLean, because that is kind of what I look at. I'm seeing this more as, you know, anybody who's opposed to this, I guess I would just ask to consider not necessarily whether you're opposed or, you know, for or against a war or the movement, but actually what it would be like to stand there at a funeral service for your loved one and have somebody yelling over the top of the service what it is they think is wrong with the way your child or your loved one lived their life. I just think that's deplorable. And so I'm interested in hearing from everybody, but I will not waver. This is important, and I want to see it done, and I really do appreciate you guys coming forward. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Any other questions, committee members? Representative Congress.
Really, it's just one comment. I mean, I think, you know, there would have been, you could probably make a good argument to test the protected speech concept, because, place and time restrictions have been upheld by the court when they're reasonable. Unwilling listeners have been protected from offensive speech. And I think, you know, we should have erred on the side of the 1,000 feet, or maybe better yet, the 3 mile distance myself, and let it work itself out in the courts if it needs to. I'm not obviously against free speech, far from it. But there's an appropriate time and place to express your political views, and it's not at a funeral. So,
thank you. Are you going to answer that or comment?
I was going to comment, but if I'll let Representative Smith go first, he might have a question for us.
Representative Smith,
thanks. Yeah, and I think our firmest footing might be, and actually, there might be amendments that are worth considering to this end, or maybe not. But but I think sort of the by invitation thing, the invited guest thing, is the strongest constitutional footing. And sort of in thinking of the free expression rights of the funeral haver, as well as distinct from that of the funeral invader, right? And I think that there, so, and that might be done differently than by saying, well, if you're picketing, right, then you go into the free speech zone, you know, and it might be if done based on if you're an invited guest or, you know, under the control or at the will of the person in charge. So anyway, I don't need to say further, but it's something we ought to think about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I do agree with you that a picket by invitation is still violative. And so if they're invited guests, then they're invited guests. But if they're invited to picket so that the holder, in essence, of the funeral, the sponsor, can therefore distinguish who violates Oregon law and who doesn't by their own assessment of the quality of the content of the speech, is not permissible under this statute. So if the Patriot Writers, and I have attended funerals where they have been there, and I've appreciated very much what they've done for the families, but if they are outside picketing, even by invitation, then this statute would apply. So they need to be attending the funeral, is what
which is why it might be worth considering a minute.
Thank you.
Thank you. Committee members, any other questions?
Yeah. Just one last one. Okay. What does the word volatile mean? And how do you spell it? I'm trying to look it up, but I don't know.
Violet.
I'm sorry, counselors.
Means colored violet, like purple.
He's not going to charge you for that.
I'll defer to Representative Conger to repair any damage that I did.
Thank you. We'll talk offline.
Yeah, the lawyers here.
I'll give you a copy of my wax law dictionary.
Chair Wisman.
Go ahead, Rick.
Chair Hovey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, in regards to Representative Smith's questionings and his concerns, it seems like to me that there must be a point in time where somebody is in violation rather than just saying, you know, they're within 300 feet. I think they need to be asked to leave first because I'm struggling a little bit with how do you determine whether or not these people are disruptive or not, and somebody has to make that determination, and certainly it seems likely that it would be the host. And the person may show up, some Freedom Riders may show up at a funeral, for example, and think that they're there, you know, offering positive support, and it may be disruptive to the family, and they, you know, so at that point, are they in violation of this law, or should they be asked to leave first, and then if they don't, they're in violation of the law? So I think, you know, that's something I think needs to be considered as well.
Chair Wisnett, Chair Holvey, with any law, local jurisdictions would have citation authority, so the law enforcement in that area would be able to make that determination, and what their process is up to them. It's, as I understand it, we're just writing a law to give them a tool for enforcement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, because this is a Class C misdemeanor, it is subject to the scienter regulations for criminal penalties, meaning that there has to be a mental state of intent. So when enforcement comes and somebody is now told you're disruptive, at that point to continue so would be evidence of intent. To withdraw would not be. I think to the extent it's a violation, the scienter drops down to criminal negligent standards, which is really not what the purpose of the statute is for. Therefore, I think in the way of application, in order to prosecute someone for violating this statute, you would have to establish the intent element. And that's why I'm comfortable, at least in my opinion, Representative Holvey, that a warning would highly likely take place. Otherwise, you couldn't prosecute.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for bringing this to us.
In closing, Chair Wisnett and Chair Holvey, I want to thank you guys for hearing this bill and listening to it closely, and I hope you will take it into strong consideration. We were very liberal in the drafting of this to try and take in everybody's concerns and needs on this bill, as you could see. And I have to tell you, you guys are a great committee, and I'm glad I brought my friend, my attorney, and author with me to stand up to your brain power. So thank you very much.
Good job. Thank you very much. Director Jim Willis, would you come up, please, Director? Good morning. Good to see you, sir, and please identify yourself. And
good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. There is no greater sacrifice a family faces than to lay to rest one of their own who has given his or her life in the service of their country. These memorial services are about our state and nation wrapping our collective arms around the family to comfort them, to care for them, to thank them, and to honor them. While they have lost a loved one, they have gained the love and admiration of many others. The irony of this bill is the ones it honors are the very ones who took an oath to defend the rights of those who would use their First Amendment liberties. We would in no way disrespect that oath and the cost paid by those who defended it. We would, however, support common sense in the application of those rights, which we believe House Bill 3241 introduces into the process. I'd like to thank this committee for your consideration of this bill and your continued support of our veterans, their families, and their survivors. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Director, thank you for your comments, and I thank you for your dedication to veterans. And I know you've attended too many of these services in honor of our veterans. Committee members, questions for the director? Thank you very much, Director.
Thank you, sir.
And I'll call up Mrs. Andrew Meyer, please.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I appreciate you taking my testimony at this time. I have to be in another committee on another bill shortly, so if I do not stay for the whole hearing, that is why. Otherwise, I would. And I do hope that as you listen to my testimony, you appreciate the reason we are here. So I shall begin. The ACLU of Oregon appears today in opposition to House Bill 3241 because we do believe that it violates the Oregon Constitution's Article 1, Sections 8, 20, and 21. Attached to my testimony, I provided the committee a memo provided to the ACLU of Oregon by attorneys Greg Chamoff and Alan Galloway of the law firm Davis Wright Tremaine of Portland, analyzing more thoroughly than my testimony will cover today the constitutionality of that, and I urge all of you to review that. The analysis is based on well-established Oregon case law and concludes that this bill violates the Oregon Constitution. We understand that similar types of legislation have been introduced in response to demonstrations by members of Fred Phelps Westboro Baptist Church. At the outset, though it should be obvious, I wish to make clear the ACLU Oregon finds the beliefs and activities of Fred Phelps and his group to be abhorrent. However, free speech and the right to protest peacefully extend to all Americans, even if their messages are unpopular, distasteful, and even hateful. As Chief Justice Roberts of the United States Supreme Court stated in the 8-1 opinion issued just yesterday when referring to Mr. Phelps and the speech his followers employ at funerals of service members, quote, speech is powerful. It can stir people to action, move them to tears both of joy and sorrow, and, as it did here, inflict great pain. On the facts before us, we cannot react to that pain by punishing the speaker. As a nation, we have chosen a different course to protect even hurtful speech on public issues to ensure that we do not stifle public debate. Such speech cannot be restricted simply because it is upsetting or arouses contempt. If there is a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it is that the government may not prohibit the expression of an idea simply because society finds the idea itself offensive or disagreeable. Indeed, the point of all speech protection is to shield those choices of content that in someone's eyes are misguided or even hurtful. I do want to note that that opinion isn't on point, as I think was mentioned. I do want to clarify that the court opinion notes that actually Maryland at the time did not have a law regarding a buffer zone. Subsequently, they did, but on page 11 of the decision, it notes that. House Bill 3241 creates a crime if a person on public property, including sidewalks, pickets at or engages in activities that are disruptive of a funeral, burial, or other memorial service within 300 feet of the property line of the residence, cemetery, funeral home, church, synagogue, or any other establishment where the service is conducted during or within 1 hour of that service. Well, I will get to the constitutional infirmities of this proposal. We believe one of the most important reasons this legislation should not move forward is because we already know that in several jurisdictions where a statute or ordinance has been enacted to ban such activity, the Westboro Church has then deliberately come into the state and sought to challenge the constitutional such regulation, often by showing up at the funerals, creating just the type of situation that House Bill 3241 seeks to avoid. It is no coincidence that the lead plaintiff in nearly every case is a member of the Phelps family or church. Stephen McAllister, a law professor in Kansas, where the church is located, observed that the Westboro Church thrives on the media attention its protests and the legislative attempts to end them generate. I quote, "The fact that their activities generate so much outrage, including so much new legislation, emboldens rather than discourages the Westboro Baptist Church. Thus, one could easily conclude that the enactment of state funeral picketing laws ironically has prolonged the practice of funeral picketing rather than deterring or stopping it. We do not want Oregon state resources to be used to give Fred Phelps a platform. We do not want to serve up a legal case that could result in not only his victory, but the possible award of attorney's fees, which will then be used to help support and fund his organization. And under the Oregon Constitution, we believe this bill is unconstitutional. Oregon's free expression provision is distinct and different from the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 states, no law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject, whatever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of this right. The Oregon Supreme Court has interpreted Article 1, Section 8 to give more protections than the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. As I've already testified in this session and other committees, our more expansive protections under the Oregon Bill of Rights are not just limited to Article 1, Section 8. In some cases, the language of our provisions is different than the federal provisions, and in some cases, it's identical. But in all cases, unlike many other states, Oregon does not interpret our state constitution provisions in lockstep with the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of federal provisions. This Oregon approach can create confusion and oftentimes leads people to believe that if something is constitutional under the federal constitution, say the First Amendment, it's constitutional under the Oregon. That is not true, and it's particularly not true here. And when examining whether or not the statute passes constitutional muster in Oregon, the Oregon courts first look to the Oregon Constitution. And if they decided under the Oregon Constitution, they don't look under the federal Constitution. As I said, the attached memo provides a very thorough analysis based on Oregon case law, and I urge you all to read it. But in summary, I want to cover a few quick points about it. We believe it violates the Oregon Constitution in at least four ways. First, the Oregon Constitution does not allow the state to restrict some ways of conveying a person's message. Peaceful picketing is one way of conveying a message that the legislative assembly may not restrict. Peaceful picketing is protected free expression in Oregon, and this bill would criminalize that protected activity. Second, restrictions on the content of speech are unconstitutional. The ban on picketing a funeral means the ban is directed to the content of the person's speech. At first glance, the bill may appear not to be directed at any particular message, but by banning speech at a time of specific activity about which individuals want to speak, the bill necessarily addresses the content of that speech. Banning picketing at a funeral is no different from banning picketing at an abortion clinic, an army recruiting station, or a politician's speech. We believe the Legislative Assembly cannot do that. And the Oregon courts have already addressed this issue in a number of rather controversial-related activities around abortion. In Lovejoy Specialty Hospital versus Advocates, the Oregon Court of Appeals ruled that the defendants had the right to picket and to demonstrate on public property in a peaceful, nonviolent manner. In Hanzo versus DePere, the Oregon Court of Appeals spoke of the discomfort of picketing, even at a person's home. And I quote, "It is unpleasant to be picketed at one's home or even at one's office, but that is the essence of picketing. It is no doubt upsetting to be denounced as a murderer merely for assisting others to exercise their constitutional rights. But the picketer, too, is entitled to exercise his constitutional rights so long as his conduct is not unlawful. Third, the bill is not a valid restriction on time, place, or manner of speech. A time, place, and manner restriction cannot restrict a person from speaking when and where the person needs to speak to make the speech worthwhile. The Legislative Assembly cannot ban speech near or during a funeral any more than the Legislative Assembly can ban picketing near the Capitol during the session of the Legislative Assembly. A time, place, and manner restriction cannot relate to the content or substance of the messages conveyed. However, it does exactly that by targeting those who picket at a funeral protest, which on its face is squarely aimed at expression. Indeed, while it would ban someone from silently picketing the funeral, it would not ban counter-protesters who are picketing the picketers. During a call-in show yesterday on national radio, as a result of the Supreme Court's decision, a father whose son died in Iraq told how the Felts notified his church prior to the service that they would be picketing outside. With that notice, it allowed the church and the family to have the Patriot Guard riders, which Representative Matthews has mentioned, attend, whose very purpose is to picket the picketers by shielding the mourning family and their friends of any protesters or group of protesters. Would the Patriot Guard riders be allowed to picket in support of the fallen soldier if this law were passed? We assume, and I think we've heard testimony, that the goal of this law is to not restrict such groups as the Patriot Guard riders, which means that the restriction is strictly based on the content of the speech. Finally, House Bill 3241 bans disruptive activities, which we believe is unconstitutionally vague. Is disruptive a physical disturbance, such as blocking an entrance? Does it extend to noises that could distract people going to or attending service? Does it mean a communication, such as a sign, that could be considered disruptive if the contents are unpleasant, even hurtful? Would a person silently holding a sign that said, "Pray for our fallen soldiers," be disruptive? A law must give a person fair warning of how to comply with the law, and the ban on disruptive behavior leaves Oregonians to guess what activities the government might or might not consider to be disruptive and therefore criminal activity. The law requires people to know what content constitutes a crime beforehand, and this does nothing to inform persons what is or isn't criminal activity. For all these reasons, we respectfully urge this committee not to proceed with this bill. Let us not bring the Phelps and their so-called church to Oregon. Let us not give them another platform to spew their hateful speech. And let us not expose the state to a legal challenge by passing a law which, with all due respect, we do believe is in clear violation of the Oregon Constitution. Thank you.
Committee members? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, let me say, and not say lightly, that you got a tough gig, and I know, seriously, and I want to publicly and on the record honor you and thank you for it.
Thank you.
But for your organization, there would be critical views that no one had the courage to offer. We may disagree at times, but you are an absolutely crucial element of the civic discourse.
Thank you.
So to the law, which I think, you know, to some degree we could say, well, we'll pass what we want to pass with the legislature and let the courts figure it out. On the other hand, we take an oath saying we're going to uphold the Constitution, and there's a couple of them we're supposed to. So I know the Oregon Constitution less well than I know the federal. And I'm not a federal constitutional expert by any score. I remember a couple cases. I've looked into a little. I haven't read the Snyder decision, but I've looked into a little. My understanding of the origin of the case was a lawsuit by the family against the protesters, picketers, whatever, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't have such a lawsuit. Which seems to me that it's that scenario is different than saying that you've got to be at a certain distance before you have your protest. I have another case I want to ask you about also, but am I right about that? I haven't read the opinion.
Thank you for letting me respond. Yes, that case is different in the sense that actually, even though there was no buffer zone, fortunately, the Phelps appear always to be quote-unquote respectful. They're quiet and peaceful, and I mean that only by their presence of not moving and their voices not being loud. Let me be clear. So it was not the challenge had to do with him seeing the information and whether the speech caused intentional infliction of emotional distress. And as you are more knowledgeable about the First Amendment, I'm more about Oregon Constitution, although our memo does briefly touch on the fact, so the court, to be clear, so the court didn't get to the issue, and it noted it wasn't addressing that issue. And the courts across the country are divided, and I've cited a few cases in the memo, or Mr. Chamoff and Mr. Galloway have cited a few federal cases where the courts are split on this issue. We've not spent a lot of time doing a thorough analysis on the First Amendment because we strongly believe that the Oregon courts will look first at the Oregon Constitution and not pursued further. So we purposely did not go into a lengthy, thorough analysis of all the court decisions that are out there that vary. Others might, but we just think it's not on point for your deliberations with all due respect.
All right. So your point of the Oregon Constitution might obviate the relevance or some degree of the relevance of what I was about to say. I do, although the reasoning might still matter. Because I remember a case way back in the day, and I had to remember the name. It was Hurley versus Irish American, Galeb, where as I recall, the unanimous decision, the court decides, there's a parade, city says, you gotta have the Irish American parade, St. Patrick's Day parade. Mm-hmm. And the city says you got to let the LGBT, the gay community organization, participate in the parade. And the parade host said, like, heck we do. It's our parade. And the parade hosts, be they homophobic or otherwise, won 9-0, right, including every liberal on the court. Mm-hmm. And with the argument being that, while the LGBT organization has speech rights, so do the hosts of the parade. And it seems to me that this is germane to mine, I didn't try to get into the legal stuff, but as I was thinking about this last night in prep, this was the thought I went to bed with, when I was asking about possible amendments, it seems if we did something not based on the content of the speech, but by the permission or non-permission of the people who were holding the funeral, that they would have, arguably, maybe, speech rights at least as powerful as the protesters. And they would have the right to say what kind of message they wanted delivered in their funeral parade. And that might include or not include the Phelps protesters or the Irish American Gay Lib protesters. So that's sort of how I was thinking it through. Tell me how I'm right or wrong.
Chair Wisnett, Representative Smith, and I am...
Does that make any darn sense,
It made sense to me as much as... And I have not read Hurley in a long time, as much as Hurley, but it was having to do, I believe, with a permitted parade activity.
Yep.
So in that case, they permitted an area that they were using exclusively. Most churches, or I assume synagogues, churches, temples, the religious facilities are all private property. So in those cases, we're really talking about the sidewalks. And I don't know whether it's permissible to get a permit for a sidewalk during the time someone's having a service inside. That's left to another day. If that were permissible, you don't need this law. In terms of the funerals and whether the cemeteries and whether, again, if they're private property, you've got a whole swath of area where it's private property and people can be asked to leave, and I don't believe that the Phelps enter into private property. They tend to stick to public spaces. If it is a public cemetery, again, to note, for whatever reason, and we can be thankful, I guess, the Phelps don't tend to, probably, as I understand it, and others may correct me, to be right there at the space where the funeral service is. Whether they could get a permit for the whole cemetery or part of the cemetery, again, I don't know. The rules would have to be neutral and regulated, and you don't need a law to pass this to have permit activities. Local jurisdictions already have permit processes. So that's as best I can answer it. I don't think you would need to pass a law to establish permit authorities, which, again, would have to be applied neutrally and allow everyone. And then I assume the scope of space might be an issue, so you can't permit a huge area that you don't intend to use, or it may create an issue if you try to create a buffer zone for permitted areas for some activities and not others. But I don't know.
Okay, committee members, and especially Representative Smith, I appreciate the way you're going, and I've tried to think about this, too, to find some way to eliminate this and make this happen. Since Mrs. Meyer is in the Capitol and we have some people to testify that are not normally in the Capitol, and I'd appreciate we can do some of this offline. I appreciate Representative Matthews, you had one point you wanted to make.
I did have one question for her. It's been 18 hours since we were opposite on another issue, and I'd like to ask her a question on this one.
Not Mr. Fedanke.
You're still connected.
Yes.
And I guess my question would be this. I mean, I'll spare you all the details. Patriot Guard riders, by the way, they don't picket. They hold the American flag, and that's not picketing by any definition. But how does your group, the ACLU, feel about the Oregon statute of harassment? 166.065. I mean, why can't we just charge people criminally? And I'll just, I don't expect you to have that off the top of your head, but, and forgive me to the lawyers, this is the cop in me coming out. A person commits crime of harassment if the person intentionally harasses or annoys another person by subjecting such person to the offense of physical contact or publicly insulting such other person by abusive words or gestures in a manner intended and likely to provoke a violent response. So I'm just kind of curious. I mean, that kind of, I would imagine that if we were to go out and lock these folks up and start arresting everybody for harassment, that then there would be a charge on your end, too, saying, you can't do that. That's freedom of speech, again. But where does it stop? And again, I'll spare you the question that I asked of anybody that would testify opposed to this bill. Think about the family and think beyond a veteran and think about perhaps somebody who may have lost their child on a SIDS death. Very, very scary thing. Sometimes communities weigh in. Sometimes they don't believe everything that they read, and they act out against that. But imagine how those folks feel. I do respect that you're here today. I really admire your courage. But I've got to say, when I look at the harassment law, I'm saying, well, you know, we're trying to prevent that as well.
Chair Wisnett, Representative Matthews, I think you are asking me to respond to how I could be here. You know, I consider it important for the ACLU to speak on an issue where we believe that it is unconstitutional. You can absolutely reject our advice, our perspective. We have oftentimes the Attorney General's opined other ways. More recently, we won a case when we opined one way. You can have three lawyers and four opinions. It is not with pleasure that I come in here. I've made it clear I think their speech is abhorrent. It is not their speech that the ACLU seeks to protect. I know it may appear to you that it is, but it is all speech. Speech, not violence or other activities. I don't know if holding a flag is or is not picketing. I'm not sure I know under this statute what picketing would be, whether that is a sign or not, or what constitutes picketing. Sometimes people just march in a circle, and some of them are carrying signs and none of them not when it's union. So, as to the harassment law, no, I cannot speak to you in authority and looking at the case law and the scope. I would just simply say that if there's a case on the books that already applies, then it's another reason to not pursue this, which is, and I think we will share this opinion, I hope, we don't want them here in Oregon. We don't want them here. And what I worry about is for them, this, not your intention, but for them, this is a red flag for them to come here. And I don't want to create Oregon where they come here, and I don't want them to challenge in Oregon and win. So I hope we share that same goal. We don't want them here.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee members, and appreciate the questioning. And also, Representative Smith, I hope that we can find some ways to make this bill happen, as I'm a sponsor of the bill. We'll ask up.
I appreciate the opportunity today, and I will try to stay for a minute, but I will probably have to leave. Thank you.
Mr. Ritter, Brian Ripp, and is it Mark Steen or Stein?
Steen.
Please come up and welcome to your capital, and appreciate your testimony, and try to be sure to identify yourself first for the record, and give us your concise testimony. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Ritter. I live at 1865 Yolanda Avenue in Lane County. I haven't really prepared any comments for this bill because I came to testify on another one. But since the opportunity is here, I wanted to support my representative, Terry Beyer, and the other representatives, the many sponsors of this bill. I also am on the board of directors of the 8th Air Force Historical Society, Oregon Chapter. And if it weren't for these veterans, we wouldn't be here being allowed to do this. And at the very least, we can honor them in peace after they've paid the ultimate sacrifice. And I hope you will support this bill. And be aware that the Westboro decision, as I'm sure you are, Judge Roberts made it clear that that was pertinent only to the particulars of that case, did not apply to the Maryland law, which is similar to what this bill proposes. So I would encourage you to go ahead with this, regardless of the Westboro decision, and support it. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead, identify yourself, sir.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Mark Steen. I'm the executive director with the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. I'm also the father of a son who's currently serving in the United States Army. I come here today on behalf of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association in support of House Bill 3241. Whether or not we've been involved with funerals, memorials, interment services where picketing has occurred, Oregon's funeral service practitioners are well aware of the negative emotional impact picketing or any protest at a funeral can have on a grieving family. The funeral or memorial for most families is just the beginning when they start to come to grips with the loss and the impact of how their lives will be changed. Picketing adds yet another layer of issues for families to deal with instead of being able to focus on paying tribute and saying goodbye to their loved ones in a dignified atmosphere. Finally, members of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association are aware of the provisions in the First Amendment and yesterday's decision by the Supreme Court. However, the court did not address whether the laws on the books currently in 44 other states in connection with picketing at funerals is constitutional. However, the court's opinion did state that it has upheld these laws in the past. The OFDA believes that House Bill 3241 speaks to common decency and does not in any way attempt to dilute the provision, but rather to ensure that grieving families have the right to grieve and mourn without interference from picketers or protesters. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank your son for his service and wish him home safe and soon.
Thank you.
Sir.
Good morning. My name is Ryan Ripp. I am 16 years old. I'm a sophomore at McNary High School. I first heard about this issue in my American government class and was outraged at the pain and suffering that it caused these military families and families in general. I felt compelled to act, so I went to my Kaiser, I live in Kaiser, went to my Kaiser City Council and was referred to Representative Kim Thatcher. I then initiated this bill through Representative Kim Thatcher, and I'm here today to support Jim Widener's bill, which my goal is to be proactive in protecting Oregon families in the future. And I have several family members who have served in the military, and I cannot imagine this happening to any one of my family members or anyone else's family for that matter. I believe that passing this bill is vital in protecting Oregon families from this emotional terrorism. That's all I have to say.
Good job, Ryan. Thank you for coming and expressing your opinion. We need more young people involved in the system, and hope you'll go back and talk about your experience. Committee members, we have questions for this panel.
Just one, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, as a funeral director, and I also have a son in the Army, so I appreciate your sentiment, but I'm curious how many funerals that you've seen where there's been protesters interrupt the funerals?
Co-chair, referring to this specific situation, these protesters have been in Oregon, I think, three or four times already. I've been involved in lots of funerals where there's been disruptions or uninvited guests. And depending on where the funeral's held, I think it's already been spoke to a little bit, funeral homes and that kind of thing, we have some control over those kind of things. It's not common. It doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Committee members, any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony to come here and participate in democracy.
Thank you.
We'll call up Becky Gisbach and Megan Tweed. And did John Nider.
Good
Thank you very much for coming to the Capitol to express your opinion. I think all of you have presented testimony, so if you could summarize it, we'd appreciate it. But please identify yourself first and give us your testimony.
Co-Chair Halvey and Co-Chair Wisnitz and members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for allowing us to come and testify today. My name is Becky Gensbaugh. I'm a mom of a full-time Army soldier. I'm also a volunteer veterans advocate and a volunteer advocate for Gold Star families. For those of you that are not familiar with the terminology of a Gold Star family, they are families that have lost somebody that were killed in action or died as a result of service of their service to our country. I'd like to first address the ORS regarding harassment. There's nothing confusing about that, where it specifically defines what harassment is, and it talks about the potential or intent of inciting violence. There's nothing confusing about that whatsoever. And if we have laws on the books and we don't use them and we don't enforce them, there's no reason of having them there. If you listen to Westboro Baptist Church, there's nothing peaceful about their picketing whatsoever. They intentionally try to incite violence. I'd like to quote the best I can from Shirley Phelps yesterday, a comment that she made on Victoria Taft's show. She said that she's sick and tired of hearing all of the whining of parents that have their babies laying in caskets that have been blown to bits. Tell me what about that comment is peaceful. Nothing at all. I'd like to kind of give you a bird's eye view of what it's like to walk through a family or walk through the process after a family's had that dreaded knock on the door. They go through the shock of losing their loved one. They wish more than ever that they could bring their loved one back to life, but they know that they're not able to. Then they have to plan the funeral. And imagine after you receive your loved one back and you're standing there at their casket. If you can imagine standing by the side of a casket when a mom, a dad, a wife, or a child, the only thing they have left is to lean over and rest on that casket and hug that casket that cradles their child inside, or their husband inside, or their parents inside. It's a total feeling of hopelessness, knowing that you can't do or say anything to really ease their pain. One of the things that those families can hold on to is knowing that their loved one died a hero. But then imagine knowing that this group is going to be there to protest your funeral and to interrupt interrupt your private time of honoring that person and laying them to rest and saying goodbye. That's their last few minutes of being able to stand by their loved one inside the casket before they're laid to rest. And that time should be sacred and it should be protected. I have a letter here from a Gold Star dad that I would like to read to you, if that's okay.
Please.
There are many memories a Gold Star parent will never forget of their child's life and their death. From the moment of Nathan's birth until the morning when two uniformed Marines walked up to my front door at 5:30 a.m. to tell me that my son had been killed in action. March 11th, 2011 will mark the four-year anniversary when Nathan was killed. With the passing of time, you learn to cope. You learn that life, no matter how seemingly impossible, still goes on. But we never forget, and the pain and the heartache never go away. You weep with your whole body and soul. You try your best to think clearly, to carry on a simple task, but then you're suddenly overcome with a tidal wave of grief. I don't think there's any loving parent that has ever lost a child that doesn't feel they've lost a slice of their sanity. It's just not right. And what is also not right are the people who make such a painful event worse by enforcing their will in a grief-stricken situation where they have no right to invade or trespass. Something I will never forget was the outpouring of people that came to welcome Nathan home. Not only just friends, but complete strangers that lined both sides of the street to honor Nathan for his sacrifice to our country. They waved flags, there were banners, and people in flags lining the street, people from all walks of life, young and old and everything in between, mothers holding their babies, and senior citizens in wheelchairs, retired military, Boy Scouts, all for my son, for what he had sacrificed for them, and to support the people he left behind, with heartfelt words of love and condolences. Just as there's no words to describe the heartache of losing your child too soon, there's no words to describe the comfort that the respect and support of these people brought me at such a difficult time in changing my life. Those memories are engraved in my heart, as is my son Nathan. Nothing can take them away. For that, I am very grateful. I can't imagine having his memorial service or going through the procession listening to people yelling and holding signs of hate-filled messages about my son. The pain is so intense as not to be described in words. To have this personal time of grief interrupted by a hate-filled group shouting and holding signs with hate and disrespect for my son and his country that he gave his life for would have been unimaginable and completely incomprehensible. Just as it is when I see this group continue to be allowed to protest at services for our other fallen heroes. Nathan and all that have sacrificed for this country are heroes, and it's their right to be honored as such and laid to rest in peace. Why isn't there a law protecting families against harassment from this group? Families have a right to privacy to bury their loved ones without being harassed by the Westboro Baptist Church or any other group that is not welcome and has not been invited. Memorial services are sacred and should be honored as every American's right, superseding anyone else's right to protest their own beliefs. My son saved the life of his whole platoon by giving away an ambush. The least our government can do is save the families from more anguish. Sincerely, Robert J. Windsor, proud father of Marine Lance Corporal Nathan D. Windsor, killed in action March 11, 2007 in Iraq. We all have our opinions on this matter, but I'd like to offer a thought to anyone that believes that the freedom of speech protects behavior like this. I believe that if you went to bury your loved one and the protesters came to disrupt that funeral with vile, sick, cruel, and abusive words, thank you, that had nothing to do with the one that you were there to say goodbye to, I guarantee you that you'd be inclined to rethink your argument. I plead with you today to do the right thing to protect and respect our freedom of speech. And I equally plead with you to protect and respect all of our fallen heroes and veterans and their families that have purchased our right to freedom of speech. Thank you.
Thank you, Becky. Be sure that Mr. Windsor has our sympathy and that we're proud of his son. Thank you for your testimony. Megan?
Forgive me if I say your names wrong.
That's okay. Co-chairs is fine.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Megan Threet. I am 16 years old. Even at my age, I know right from wrong. I know that freedom of speech has limits. For example, if a student comes to high school and starts yelling out bad names and was disruptive, they could be suspended because they would be stepping on the rights of other students. It'd be disrupting the education process, and it would be interfering on the rights. It'd be interfering on others' rights. If a student did such a thing, they could be suspended from school, especially especially if it was repeated behavior. My oldest brother is a full-time soldier in the Army, and so our family is very patriotic. If it is okay with you, I would like to read something that my mother had written for the Estacada Memorial Day ceremony.
Please.
The title is "There's No Simply Greater Than Love." John 15:13 says, "There's no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. Over time, thousands of heroes have given their all so that we can be free to stand here today and choose the words we use free to choose our faith, free to choose our voice, free to choose to voice our opinions, our complaints, and our praises, and free to sing the songs we choose to. There's simply no greater love than that. Every member of the military and their loved ones know that when they march off to war, they might not come back, but they go anyway. Leaving their loved ones behind, they don their uniforms and patriotic spirits. They go willingly to make our nation safer and to make it a better place where freedom can stretch her wings. There's simply no greater love than that. The camaraderies, I think I pronounced that right, is one that is hard to match. They live by words, no man left behind. The sacrifices that are made by members of the military and their families are too often taken for granted. What does it mean when we say a fallen soldier, fallen hero gave their all? Think about it. They gave their very life, their dreams, their tomorrows, their laughter, their tears, their time with family and friends. They gave it all. How much more can a person love another or love their country than giving their all? There's simply no greater love. What about those who fought for our freedom and came back from war injured? Those who have lost their limbs, those who still suffer from terrible physical and emotional pain. There's simply no greater love than that. Let's not forget the family members that go to war. Pardon me. Let's not forget the family members of those that go to war. Moms and dads, spouses and children, and the countless teardrops shed. For them, there are many sleepless nights and the anxiety of fearing that dreaded knock on the door to tell them that their loved one gave their all. There's simply no greater love than that. When we are willing to what are we willing to sacrifice for them in return? Do we look for ways to give back to those that give so freely and willingly? Do we tend to the big things they need help with? Are we quick to lend a helping hand, share a meal or a cup of coffee? Do we open a door, send a greeting card, remember a birthday or anniversary? Do we make an effort to go out of our way to shake the hand of a veteran or a person in uniform? Do we take care of the parents, spouses, and children of our fallen heroes? What do we do for the ones who so willingly would or did give their all? Remember those who are not with us today. Celebrate with those who are. Sleep well tonight, my friends, for our nation is protected by our finest men and women who gave their all. There's simply no greater love than that.
Thank you, Megan. Thank you very much. John? Go ahead and identify yourself, please.
Thank you very much. Co-chairs, members of the committee, appreciate a lot of you come and testify here today. My name is John Meter. I'm from Mankato, Oregon. I'm a 26-year Air Force veteran, retired. I'm also a member of several veteran organizations. I've submitted my testimony, so you pretty much have it all in front of you. I just want to say that the Westboro Baptist Church, as one group, has already been to Oregon. So passing this law, whether they come back because of the law or not, they've already been here. They will be back. This is not going to bring them here. It's not going to stop them from coming here. But I think it will place some restrictions on what they can do when they are here. As I've said in my statement, we have laws already in place that prevent you from screaming and yelling in your backyard at 2 o'clock in the morning. But you can do it at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. There's a time and a place. And it's the same sort of thing with this legislation. I look at this legislation as nothing more than saying to the protesters, not now and not here. You're free to speak your piece. You're free to say as you please. in another place or at another time. You can do it here if you want to, but not now. Come back an hour after, and you can protest all you want. I spent a good portion of my life in the military and in law enforcement defending people's rights. And freedom of speech is one of our basics. I would never put a restriction on a person's ability to freedom of speech. But you need to realize that there are necessarily some restrictions just by our laws. You can't yell in a theater. You can't, as I put out here, I couldn't come and speak to you about the benefits of playing bagpipes and give you a demonstration. It would be inappropriate for this committee. All I'm saying is these protesters, what they're doing is inappropriate at the time and place they're doing it. And they need to be restricted from that.
Thank you very much, John, for your service to the country, your testimony today, and also your service as a law enforcement officer. Questions, committee of this panel? Thank you very much for coming. It's nice to have a 16 and a 17-year-old testifying today in the Capitol. Mr. Brenneman, John Brenneman here, signed up to speak. I think he's the president or the previous speaker we had, Rip, was it, that spoke on the Funeral Association. The public members that are here understand that this is a public hearing. There's been some discussion about possible amendments, so we'll hope we can bring some amendments back. And as a sponsor of this bill, I hope we'll be able to bring it forth as a work session. But thank you for coming to the Capitol to testify today. The committee members, we're okay on this?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
That's the end of the testimony. I'll just say one thing in case it doesn't come back. I was sort of hoping the cameras actually would not be here because I'm not interested in preening. But, the first Oregonian killed in the war was from my hometown, and I knew him. He was a basketball player. He had some basketball camps. And, I'm not a legal beagle, and I don't know exactly why this bill's here versus judish, if this is a criminal thing. I have no idea. Bottom line is... I'm going to support the bill, first of all. The legislative council would have weighed in on unconstitutionality. That's the basic question. If they want to come back to Oregon, it's fine. If they had come to Coos Bay, they would not have left. I guarantee that.
Thank you, Representative. Committee members, no other comments on this bill? Then we'll close the work session on House Bill 3241. Public hearing. Public hearing on House Bill 3241. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2945. Representative Clem, and you're going to be joined by Senator Edwards.
And actually, if you don't mind, he's still in a radio interview, and yeah. I brought a local person from Salem to talk with
him. Go ahead. That's fine. Is that Mr. Getty or?
Kreitzberg, Mike Kreitzberg.
Okay.
May not even be on the list.
Thank you, Representative. Just as a reminder, introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Brian Clem. I represent parts of Central and East Salem and a bunch of unincorporated people east of Salem who are the focus of why I'm interested and sponsored this bill. And I'll let Mike tell his story in a second about what happened so you can hear it firsthand. The issue here is what happens when you live in the county and you go in to get some type of service from a city. And in many cases, people who live in a county because their water systems have failed or something like that, they get city services, and at that time, they're usually, in most cities, asked, since you're hooking up to city services now, like water and sewer, you're asked to sign something saying you'll agree to be annexed at that time. What I encountered going door-to-door was a bunch of people who weren't hooking up to city water and sewer at all,
or getting city services of any kind. And yet they were still forced to be annexed because the city, or to voluntarily sign something saying, I will agree to not fight annexation. This then triggers something called triple majority annexation or some other types of annexations where it appears, for all intents and purposes, the person has asked to be annexed, even though they don't want to be annexed. But to get, for example, a building permit, the city got to weigh in, even though these people live in the county and they don't get any city services, the cities would require them to voluntarily, but not really voluntarily, consent to annexation. Usually it's called a non-remonstrance agreement. You have to sign it saying, I won't contest annexation, I want to be annexed. We call this the hostage annexation because you get blackmailed. You can't get your service unless you sign the paper. Now, what you'll hear from some cities is this is currently illegal. We don't need this law. So I'm bringing you someone who it happened to, and there are many other people it happened to, so you can hear, because there will be people who claim this does not occur and it's currently illegal and it doesn't happen. But I have investigated this quite thoroughly, and I'm quite certain it does in fact happen. And I asked a business owner who's he and his company employ a lot of people in this town, and I just wanted you to hear the story firsthand from my he's not a constituent, but he's an associate of mine.
Thank you, Representative. Is this Mr. Moore, then?
This is Mike Kreitzberg.
Mike Kreitzberg.
And
Mike,
say your name for the record.
Identify yourself, sir, for the record, and give
Mike Kreitzberg.
Testimony.
So I have a company, a manufacturing company, located on Boone Road, corner of Boone Road and Turner Road. 2007, I needed to expand my operations, so I ordered a steel building and got all excited about putting up an addition to our shop. And at the time, we were located in Marion County. And I went to Marion County to get a building permit. And we started through that process. And they got out a map and they said, oh, you're in the urban growth boundary. You've got to go talk to the city of Salem. So I went over to the city of Salem, and they said that in order for me to get permission from them to get a building permit from Marion County, I had to get annexed into the city of Salem. I said, I don't want to be annexed, but if that's what I have to do to get a permit, then tell me what to do. So they gave me a form, and I filled it out. And then, I don't remember exactly how this happened, what the reasoning was, but I had to pay $4,800 to the city of Salem. And at that point, I was thinking, oh, wait a minute, what am I doing here? I'm paying the city of Salem for permission to get a building permit from Marion County, it appears. I'm signing up to be annexed, and I really don't want to be annexed, but I need this building permit, so, okay, I guess that's what we'll do. And I asked, am I going to get water? You know, we're on a well and a septic now. No, don't get water. Do I get sewer system? Nope, no sewers. How about a sidewalk? No sidewalk, no street, nothing from the city. But permission to go back to Marion County and get a building permit, which I did. And, again, I never wanted to be annexed, so when the actual annexation happened, I didn't vote for it. I encouraged everybody that worked for me not to vote for it, but we got annexed in anyway. And then I got a bill, and I got to pay for part of the cost of, you know, the printing and the all of the stuff it takes to get the annexation thing on the ballot and manage that. So I never really griped too hard about the whole thing because I wanted my building permit. I didn't want to hassle with the city or anything like that. I had a machine. I had to get into the building. I had the building laying on the ground, and I just wanted to move ahead. But I've known Brian for a number of years, so I griped to him about it, and here I am today.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Yeah, it was a weird deal, and I never really felt good about it.
Thank you for describing that situation. Committee members, we will have League of Oregon Cities testifying, but if you have questions for Representative or Mike?
No.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment. And I just appreciate, you know, we hear about problems, we hear about bills, and representatives bring them forward, like Representative Clement, I appreciate that. But rarely do we get the individual that's really, truly impacted and been impacted to be able to say, this truly does occur, and it occurred to me, and here's what it costs, and it's not right. And so thanks for taking the time. I know you've got a business to run, and you're a busy man, but thanks for coming to the Capitol and presenting the testimony.
Sure.
Thank you.
I just hope it doesn't happen to somebody else down the line.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kreitzberg and Representative Clem for bringing the bill forward. Just to clarify, so you were not hooked up to city water ahead of time?
No.
So you're still on a well?
Right.
But to get your, I just want to make sure, to get your building permit from Marion County, because you were in the urban growth boundary, Marion County said you had to go to the city of Salem.
Right.
Was
the city of Salem said I had to be annexed in order to get a building permit from Marion County. Said I don't want to be annexed in.
Had to agree to sign the form saying you wouldn't contest annexation.
I said I can't wait for this whole process of annexation. So they said, well, if you'll agree to it, we'll let you get your and pay the. I think it was $4,800.
Mr. Chair, if I may,
yes, sir.
Follow up. And I guess is there anything on the books anywhere that forces that issue to happen today? Maybe we're going to hear that testimony from League of Oregon Cities how they can. Marion County can force you to go back to the city just because you're in the urban growth boundary.
So, Mr. Chair, Cameron, so I had a conversation with the city of Salem yesterday. I don't think they're here, but they may submit some written testimony, I think. And they're opposed to the bill, and their position is it's currently illegal and doesn't happen. And so I have nice people, but I put them on the phone with Mike and had him explain it. And in the end, I mean, I think she was at a loss because she's told this does not occur, and clearly it did occur. He's not on city services. And this isn't the first time. I met a lot of people going door to door who were trying to remodel like something out in the backyard, and they had the same thing happen. They said, I don't want to be annexed, and I don't want to be on city water and sewer. I'll pay my own way. I don't want to be. But to get the to get permission, they ended up having to do it. And I think there's an LC letter out there saying this is currently already illegal. So a few times, Representative Crummell, this was a big thing for him. He gave constituents the letter, and they took it in to Tiger, to wherever it was, and they then let him off. But you had to know him and have the letter to get out of it. And so the position of the city saying was this is currently already not lawful to do what happened to him and that it does not occur.
Thank you.
And she didn't know how to reconcile this part either.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very related, although a little different, the history of my district. So so in the late 80s, early 90s, City of Portland made a deal with landowners saying that if you agree to annexation, we'll hook you up to the sewer system and it'll save you like $20,000, right? But it'll be $20,000 more if you don't so agree. And I apologize for this being two times in a single day when I'm citing case precedent. It does feel like a different committee. But the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, Hussey decision, ruled that was unconstitutional. Right? We weren't allowed to do that based on, it was an unconstitutional penalty of one's fundamental right to vote. Have your own opinion. But nothing happened. Right afterwards, so I think it is very likely, very conceivable, that the governing appeals court of our region says it's illegal to do what the city of Portland did, but it's still stuck. They still did it. On remand, they said, "Oh, there's no remedy, so it's just going to stick." So I could absolutely imagine a scenario where you're not supposed to do it, but it happens anyway.
Okay, and we've been joined by Senator Edwards. You want to give it? You had some testimony, Senator.
As well, so I'm just going to get up and let and return if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and Co-Chair.
Mr. Getty, you want to join your senator?
So, for the record, my name is Chris Edwards. I'm State Senator in North Eugene, West Eugene, and Junction City. I'm here to very briefly just let you know a little bit about my support for this bill, and then I'd like to defer to my constituent so that you can hear from him how this is actually affecting real people. In the Eugene and Springfield area, in Eugene and unincorporated, inside the urban growth boundary, but unincorporated. We have a system where there's an intergovernmental agreement between Lane County and the City of Eugene that states that the City of Eugene will issue building permits inside the urban growth boundary. And so if you're in unincorporated territory, then, and you want to build something on your property, then you need to, of course, get a building permit, which means that you need to go to the City of Eugene because of the intergovernmental agreement. The City of Eugene can then say, well, we'd be happy to give you your building permit should you request to be annexed. And so I say request with quotation marks around it, because in my view, they're holding you hostage. And so I call it hostage annexation. And so this is a bill that addresses that. And I don't think it's right. And I think we ought to change that. And I will defer the rest of my time to my constituent, who can tell you how it really plays out and how it affects real people.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Getty, please identify yourself. And let's.
Yeah, I'm Bob Getty. My wife is also here in the audience. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for allowing me to present this. You all have a copy, I think, of the information that I'm going to try to summarize, but I'll probably end up reading most of it. Anyway, we purchased a lot in the River Road area of Eugene, which at that time was in the county. And we purchased that in 1964 in Audell Estates, which was a subdivision. And at that time, we built a home on that lot. In 1971, we purchased an adjacent lot in what was called the first addition to Audell Estates, which was also an approved subdivision. If you have that available to you, if you could look at this map, it'll show you that it's the two lots are adjacent to each other in the subdivision, okay? We live on the upper lot, lot 3, and the one that says 8 down there is the lot in question that I'm going to be talking about. We still reside in the same home in the River Road area. Our thoughts at the time we bought that was that we would use that 1971 purchased lot as a garden and play yard until such time as our three children were grown and away from home, and then sell our home and its lot, as noted above, that we built on in 1964. We could then use the proceeds of that sale to build a smaller home and or do a minor partition on the adjacent lot, which, as you can tell, is an unusual configuration. This would enable us to downsize our home to two persons and to reduce the care and upkeep on that large lot. I'm now 76. My wife, a couple years younger, would desire to be able to do that. And essentially what we planned, as I mentioned up above, which includes some options to take into account our anticipated or our unanticipated needs as we get older. At the time of our purchase, both of those lots, there was no requirements to be annexed to the City of Eugene, and several years ago, Lane County turned over the permitting processes to the River Road, in the River Road area, to the city. We can't really talk to the City of Eugene about it because we're not citizens of the city. We cannot vote for any city positions or have any say in the decisions they make. And anyway, why would they listen to us? Because we don't have any clout. We can't vote in the city anyway. There have been a multitude of changes in the land use regulations and laws, particularly in the River Road area, which now make it practically impossible for us to do anything with that lot to accomplish those goals. We submitted a determination of need to annex or execute an agreement, which is also part of the packet. It's front and back on that. To the City of Eugene Planning Division in January of 2009. It was denied later in that month and is non-appealable, according to what this says, because the city requires annexation before permits can be issued. And if 207 can no longer allow annexation because the lot is not contiguous to any other city property, nor is the lot that we have our home on contiguous to any other city property. You got to realize if this is the county, and the city over the years have, before 07, had come in, if anybody wanted to develop any property in that area, they required that that lot or that area be annexed. So there was a lot here, there's a lot here, there's a lot here, there's a parcel here, 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 in the whole county, okay, but in the River Road area. So they had what I call island annexations. I guess it's also called non-contiguous annexations that they had already done. So for several years before 07, the city of Eugene required those annexations before a property owner in the River Road area could obtain permits to build on or partition a lot, and did in fact annex a huge amount of properties through what I just described. Both of our properties are still in Lane County and not in the city of Eugene, and neither are contiguous with any other previously non-contiguous island annex properties that the city of Eugene had already required and people had done and done what they wanted to with the property. We should not have to join the city just to get permits. Therefore, our lot that we purchased in 71 cannot now be used to build a home on any part of it. And as I understand, we cannot create a minor partition just to divide that lot into two lots. We can't even attach it to our existing lot if we were to want to sell that to the existing lot that our house is on. This leaves us with a large lot that we must still pay taxes on. We cannot build on it. We cannot partition it. We cannot attach it to our existing property, as I mentioned, and essentially cannot sell it. Who would want to buy that property that cannot be built upon, even though it's a lot in an approved subdivision with all required services available, including water and sewer? They're all down the street. They go right by that lot in that cul-de-sac and supply to other houses in that area. We've been deprived, we think, of a substantial part of our planned retirement. And I'd be glad to answer any questions that you all might have. It's similar to what the person was talking about in Salem. It's a little bit different, but it's similar to that. So if you have some questions, I'll try to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Gentry, for bringing that forth and going through your representative to bring this matter to us. Committee members, you have questions. We will be having League of Oregon Cities to respond, and the City of Lincoln City representative is going to be here. Representative Hovey, Chair Hovey.
Thanks, and thanks for coming up and giving us your testimony today. And as you listened to the previous testifier, he was, you know, in a situation where he wasn't receiving any services or wasn't required to hook up to sewer or water. Is your property, it looks like it is served by the sewer and water?
There's sewer that comes down that street. There is water that comes down in that cul-de-sac area. It's right there and available. Yeah.
Right, and so this property to build on it is being required to hook up to that sewer and water. And so is that the basis for them? For their annexation?
No, they're saying, if you look on the back side of your whole packet, they cite certain things here. They're saying that, now you got to remember, this is in 07.
Mm-hmm.
Just prior to 07, this contiguous issue would not have been an issue, and I could have annexed. The only reason I filled this out was because I didn't know, nor did the people, the builder that helped me do it, didn't know
mm-hmm.
about the fact that it had to be contiguous. So if you read what they have on here, it, as I understand it, It says annexation is subject to compliance with the requirements and approval criteria or however beginning and such and does not appear to be an immediate option. And based on the information provided, that's up above. So anyway, you can read that.
Thank you. You have another bill.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I guess my point was that they were, you know, the property's required to be hooked up to sewer and water that's provided
by
the city.
Yeah, well, it's not, I don't know if you call it, you're from Eugene, so you kind of know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's E-Web, it is a city operation, but they're not really I don't call up the city to get them. Okay.
Right. And the wastewater sewer system as well.
And the sewer system is the same. And there is a connection when we bought that lot. No, not when we bought it, but later on when they forced, put sewers in.
I just wanted to understand that there were
but
city
there
services.
There is a connection in that sewer line to serve that property. Mm-hmm. It doesn't actually hook up to it.
And Mr. Okay. Co-Chair, I would submit to you that through this bill, we're not seeking that nobody get services that they don't pay for. But I would also submit to you that there are other ways to construct an intergovernmental agreement that would require, if you're using, if you're using eWeb services, you should pay for eWeb services. I absolutely believe that. But we're talking about being annexed to the city of Eugene and paying city of Eugene property taxes, which, as of a couple of years ago, averaged about $1,200 more per year. So, for like properties, this one in the city, this one not in the city. There's a lot more than just the direct service of water and sewer that's at issue here. And I would certainly say that if you are receiving water and sewer provided by eWeb, then you shouldn't pay for that.
Nobody's already received water and electricity from eWeb on our present house. You have to come up to make testimony. You can not do it from the audience. I'm sorry.
I can repeat that.
Hey, this is Mr. Getty. And
okay, this is Mr. Getty. And that what she said is true, that we do have city and sewage service to our existing house, as do all these other lots except for one other one in that whole two subdivision areas that don't.
Thank you.
I mean, they're not connected, but they do have it of all available.
Please understand, we record it, so we have to have the recorded documents, so
that's
why we don't allow.
Do you want to come up and say something?
Okay. All right, thank you very much.
But anyway, it's very, very frustrating to us to be in a situation to where really we're being blackmailed. And somebody else already used that before you came in, so I guess that's all right if I used it.
Thank you for bringing this issue to us and for your testimony. We've got Mr. Moore and
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee, and I appreciate all the help.
Mr. Moore, and he traveled over 100 miles, and also Mr. Ritter, Jerry Ritter, would you come up, please? Please identify yourself. Thank you for coming, and appreciate your testimony. Mr. Moore, we have your letter. If you could summarize, we would appreciate it. We're going to try to get one more bill if we can.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, thank you for taking time to hear this important issue. My name is Mitchell Moore. I reside at 9680 Southwest Buckskin Terrace in Beaverton, Oregon. I also own property in the unincorporated areas within the urban growth boundary of Lincoln City. House Bill 2945 is the first of a pair of bills that seek to remedy misuse of a common set of Oregon statutes. It's often helpful in cases like House Bill 2945 to examine the original legislative intent of the statute proposed for revision. I provided you with a written report that details that intent as part of my testimony today. Allow me to briefly summarize. This problem began in 1991 when the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 3498, amending past annexation legislation to encourage
coordinated planning between local governments and local residents who have a shared interest in annexation. That bill was requested by the City of Eugene, who wished to be allowed to set an effective date for annexation of up to 10 years into the future. During that proceeding, lawmakers recognized that Oregon law lacked any statutory authorization supporting annexation contracts between a city and individual property owners. Therefore, the bill was amended to recognize the legality of consent to annex contracts pertaining to the provision of extraterritorial services. Some may argue that House Bill 3498 in 1991 gave cities permission to require consent to annexation contracts in exchange for the provision of county services as a proxy. However, that was not the intent of that legislation. Today, you will hear several compelling reasons why this bill is necessary. Additionally, I would ask you consider that the original intent of the statute was to address the construction of mutually agreed upon extraterritorial service infrastructure projects, not the provision of proxy services between local governments. I encourage you to move this bill forward to the floor for consideration. It's a good first step towards rectifying the issues created in 1991, which led to the undesirable practices of today. Mr. Chairman, thank you for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you very much for that concise report and bringing this testimony. Mr. Ritter, if you'll go ahead.
Thank you.
By yourself, please.
Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holvey, and members of the committee. And thank you, Representative Clem, for introducing this bill. We appreciate it. I represent Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexations. We are very much in support of this legislation. And let's clarify, as Mr. Moore pointed out, that we're dealing with situations here where a city is providing a county service as a surrogate. In other words, the county would normally be the provider of the service, but the city is providing it under an IGA. We have several reasons for supporting the bill. First is a lack of necessity. We see no legitimate reason for a city to be requiring annexation in these kind of circumstances. The next reason is lack of statutory requirement. We know of no ORS or OAR that requires a city to compel annexation in these situations. Next reason is a legal opinion, which we provided to you, that Legislative Council rendered in 2006, which states, and I quote, "A city may require consent to annexation only for delivering its own services, not for acting as an agent of the appropriate service provider," and we provided a site for that. That is this letter here. If you need copies of it, we can provide that. The next reason is probably the most important, is fairness. We just don't believe it's fair to hold property owners hostage in these kinds of situations. The bill does not deprive cities of going through normal annexation procedures under state statute if, for example, they are providing their own services. There's another bill before you, House Bill 3144, that will address those situations. So in summary, we believe the annexation reforms proposed in this bill are reasonable, they're defensible, and we ask for your endorsement. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Good. Thank you for your testimony. We do not have that letter, so if you'll make that letter available, we'll be sure that the
Mr. Chair, I'll do that.
Thank you. Any questions of these witnesses, committee members? Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Moore, thank you for driving up and testifying. Joan Kelsey and Linda Ludwin, please.
Lincoln City may deal maybe different. I'm not sure what's going on.
Good morning. Please identify yourself and provide us your concise testimony on this.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I've also asked our league counsel, Mr. Chad Jacobs, to come up with us in case there's any questions here that I can't respond to. In terms of the bill, our initial thought, as I read the bill initially, it appeared to codify the 1994 Court of Appeals case, Bear Valley Sanitary versus the City of Medford, that interpreted the portion of statute that you heard about through a prior witness, Mr. Ritter, and the gentleman that talked about the prior House Bill 34-something-something, which basically codified that statutory site that said cities may obtain annexation consents when they provide services. So that was our read initially of the bill and the intent of the bill. And frankly, we don't disagree with that court case or that interpretation of 222 or as 222.115. However, as we continue to review the bill language itself, there was enough ambiguity that we do have concerns enough to oppose the bill. And I'll bring back a couple of those concerns, but I'd like you to hear from Joan Kelsey from the City of Lincoln City. And I would also like to note that the situations with so far the various testifiers, there's nuances of differences that Co-Chair Holvey picked up, and we are also trying to pick up the information specific to those cases. I am not prepared to comment today about the City of Eugene's practices or the testimony that we heard or the City of Salem's. It's very difficult for us on this end to testify to those specific circumstances. There is one thing that occurred that I'll bring your attention to, though, in the City of Eugene that may have something to do with what you heard from Mr. Getty, and that is in 2007, becoming effective in 2008, the Lane County Boundary Commission was abolished. They previously did the annexations, and their rules for annexations at that time, before the City of Eugene took over, were different in terms of contiguity and several other annexation requirements. So I'll give that to you. But more than that, I cannot comment on those unique, specific cases in those cities.
Thank you. Mrs. Kelsey.
Thank you, Co-Chair Wilson and Co-Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Joan Kelsey. I'm the city attorney for the City of Lincoln City. I beg your patience. I've never spoken to an August committee before, so I'm going to try to be efficient with my time. I have provided you some written testimony, two pieces. One is my testimony, which attempts to summarize some of the background of the situation in Lincoln City's longstanding annexation program, and a copy of the most recent ordinance number 2010-10, which modifies the policies that the city has had in place beginning in 1978. And this is not a full copy of what the city's code reads today, but only a recent modification. And I bring those to you not because I want to read them or take your time with that, but to explain in part what our concern is not about. I heard the testimony from other people this morning, and I believe that there are some individual situations involving annexation and building permits. I'm not sure how this specific bill will address that problem. I do know that, as I read it, it creates a number of questions that I have about voiding existing contracts in which a city or maybe a local district provided services directly to a customer, and the consideration for that agreement was obtaining a consent to annex by the service provider, meaning by the city or by the district. My concern is only with Lincoln City. I can only speak to the facts in Lincoln City. The other thing I'm not speaking about today is annexation elections. The consents to annex that Lincoln City has obtained are all involved in a program aimed at triple majority, meaning it's a slow, gradual program. As services are extended, as property hooks up, the city then receives that consent. I believe that sections 4 and 5 of the bill are problematic as drafted. What section 4 does is it amends current law to add a time frame for when a consent to annex can be obtained relative to providing the service. And it uses the word before providing the service. There are all kinds of circumstances where a consent to annex may be obtained, but where I think you could arguably say that service is already in existence. There may be a new owner. There may be transfer of property from one utility customer to another utility customer. There are a number of different circumstances. The city has been carefully adhering to what we understand the law is in obtaining those consents. And, in fact, because the city had a longstanding agreement with the water district to provide water service within the Rhodes End area outside the city, a part of that agreement was that the water district would dissolve and the city would take over those services. And because there were protests against the consents, there were people who believed that those consents were forced. The city basically filed a declaratory judgment action to get a legal opinion. The U.S. District Court ruled on that in 2008 and determined that the consents that the city had obtained were valid under its existing program and looked very carefully at it. In fact, cited to the Bear Creek Valley case and said that doesn't apply because the city is directly providing those services. And I believe it has a single sentence summary that very cogently explains how at least the Oregon Court of Appeals understood that case. I believe if the bill goes forward as drafted, it will be extremely problematic, not just for Lincoln City, but for a number of other cities who maybe are not aware of legislation that may be intended at solving some other problem that doesn't appear to be directly solved by the bill. I'd like to correct two minor errors in my written testimony. On the first page, I said that the city renewed efforts to negotiate annexation plans, but were no successful. I meant to say not successful. That's at the last paragraph on page one. And on page two, under the first sentence of my analysis paragraph, I said that the bill appears to redefine a contract between a city and a service provider. I meant between a city and a service customer. That's an important distinction. I do believe that it raises the question whether if some consents are unwittingly invalidated, whether the city would be in the position of terminating that water service, which is not something that the city would be eager to do.
Thank you. Good job. And Mr. Jacobs.
Chad Jacobs, General Counsel from the League of Oregon Cities. I'm just here at Linda's request to help answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. Thank you very much. Committee members, questions?
Representative Quinn?
He has to go.
Sorry. Okay. So to those of you who have some specific issues, are you willing to work on amendments that you think get your situation resolved or just straight oppose the bill? Which is to both of you, actually, please.
My answer was I was hoping that I could be as neutral as possible on sticking to the facts. I'm still concerned that I can't understand the specific direction or issue that is trying to be resolved or addressed. If it is codifying the decision in Bear Creek Valley, I think the court very clearly states what it believes is that the body extending the service is the body that has to obtain the consent. I think that's very clear. The issue here is adding a timeline for when those consents can be obtained and defining that, which does not exist in the statute now, and then invalidating what could be a large number of consents that are not intended to be invalidated but could be invalidated. That's the ambiguity. So we could work on it, but I'm still grappling with, I'm not quite sure how I could improve that language rather than to just say don't amend the current statute. It's pretty clear.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to hear Linda's response, and then I do have a response.
But, of course, we'll help if we need to.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Clem, I will call on my legal counsel here if I get too far afield to correct me back. Our position would be such that if the intention of the bill was to codify the Bear Creek Valley sanitary decision, that was the basis of 222.115, that would say that a city may obtain consents if it provides the service. We would definitely not oppose that. If we go further, however, when you go further into the bill in Section 5, you go into the void of annexation consents that have been given previously for pursuant to an intergovernmental agreement. We believe that's the what Section 5 says. We have questions. It gets a little blurry. Let me give you a situation. We have situations where those consents were obtained, and then in the early 90s, mid-90s, a city has already annexed that, provided, gone forward with an annexation for consents that under this bill may be declared void, yet that annexation occurred 20 years ago. We have concerns, situations like that that may occur. And so that portion of the bill we have to be concerned about.
So, Falder,
yes,
I know we're short on time, but the obviously the word given is pretty loosely used around here. Mr. Kreitzberg is the situation that I'm thinking of. He doesn't, I understand you have water going to these places, and that's not what I was interested in here. And I've talked to some other folks about amendments that would be about really temporary services, like building permits, that are on behalf of some other entity. But real, you know, whether the bill language matches exactly, there's somebody's sanitary something, I don't even know what that is, to be honest. That's not what I based it on. It was based on constituents telling me I got blackmailed or held hostage or sometimes foul language, and then those two words, by the city of Salem, in order to just get something done out on my county property, and I don't have anything other than a well and a septic tank. I don't even like you people, you know, talking to me, you government people, I don't like you. Can you leave my house? That's usually how the conversation went. And I said, no, I'd like to help you. And then eventually they would talk to me about what happened, and then eventually, I brought a bill forward to try and help them.
That helps me understand a little bit better the purpose. If the concern centers around the building permit issuance process and how a city might do that on behalf of the unincorporated area and what that agreement is with the county in their urban growth management concern, to me that sort of shifts more. It's partly in the land use arena, partly in the building permit arena, but less focuses on the services actually being provided. If the intent of the bill is to address really services, that's why we're here as a service provider. If it's really a land use building permit issue, there may be some other way that we could help address that.
Just one last statement for that. I mean, the tough part for me is when people keep telling me this is currently already settled law, and yet it's happening to my constituents, and they don't know how to get a lawyer to go talk to somebody at the counter that, no, you are committing a violation of some precedent set here. Please stop doing this to me. They don't know that. So they want a statute that makes it clear, don't make the constituent rely on a legal precedent they may not know about. If it's already settled law, then let's just stick it, codify the settled law and have cities stop doing this.
And for the record, Chad Jacobs from the League of Warren Cities, the Bear Valley Creek decision is that precedent that everyone's relying on that you're talking about. And to the extent that we want to codify that so people can rely on that, it's certainly something that we can work with you to come up with language to figure out how to do that.
But one last comment, Mr. Kocher, Representative Clem. I think that there are different interpretations of the word services that is being used in the bill. The Bear Valley case dealt with hard infrastructure. Building code enforcement, building permits, is not typically called a service, and there may be some different interpretation of what this bill does given the definition of service, which is not defined.
Well, I'm open to suggestions versus just plain opposition, if you're interested.
Thank you. Representative Chair Hovey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Clem. Just follow up on that conversation specifically, and you can get back because we're running out of time to me on a couple of these issues. I'm kind of curious about the differences between a city providing services directly or through an intergovernmental agreement, because that also seems to be somewhat of an issue here to me. And so is there a difference, and what is that difference, and is that established in that particular court case there? If it's through an intergovernmental agreement and the city's providing it, is it considered the city's providing the services? And then the other question I had was in terms of the building permit issues, because a lot of these seem to, you know, come around in the building permit issues. And I think in the Salem case described maybe a little bit different than the Eugene case. I'm not certain, but I know you're not here, but I hope that you contact those two cities and see if you can get some feedback from them, because I'd like to hear their side of this story. But is there a land use and perhaps a health question or something that comes into play when there's a building permit requested and the particular land use or zoning or some other regulation requires that can't go forward unless they're hooked up to, for example, city services, water and sewer usually are the most common. And so is that a different animal than the Salem case and why? So those are some questions I would like you to get back to me on at your leisure, but soon.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Public members, thank you for bringing this issue to the committee. I think we had some good testimony. Hopefully we can come up with some solutions to help our citizens. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3360. Or excuse me, 2945, close the public hearing. Members, it appears that our time has expired, and I see no out-of-Salem or non-Salem people signed up to testify on that great bill, House Bill 3360, brought to you by Representative Wisnett, and my co-chair has agreed we'll carry that over to our next scheduled meeting, and we'll adjourn the committee. Thank you.
This other guy, he didn't want you to see there. He couldn't afford to put it.